This is Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. It's April 1st, and this is going to be a different kind of podcast, mainly because I'm doing it with no notes. It's primarily going to be a stream of consciousness because why not? So it's going to be some thoughts that are in my head, and then there's going to be a music section where, if you stick with me, it's not a long podcast, I promise, you won't be tortured this week, but I'm going to reveal the greatest album of all time. And this was not lightly considered. This was with me spending, I don't know how many, hundreds of hours over the last year. This has been a project that I've been working on. I've listened to every rock album, every new wave, every alternative, every punk, classic rock, doo-wop, all of it, hard rock, death metal, you name it. And I've come up with the greatest album of all time. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, because mainly because I'm right. But some of the things I wanted to talk about this week were just some meandering thoughts that I had in my head, maybe some observations. Some of them were sort of reminiscing about days gone by. I remember as a kid, this was a thing, just so you know, in the 70s. It was a thing to have a lemonade stand. I'm not kidding. I mean, now you're in a day and age where you're afraid your kids are going to get kidnapped, they're going to be killed, they're going to be poisoned, they're going to be molested. Back then in the 70s, even though we had the Tylenol poison scare where some lunatic was putting poison into Tylenol bottles, I mean, there weren't safety caps and things like that to prevent tamper-proof labeling. You just would go to the store and you'd buy Tylenol. You could just open it up and do whatever you wanted and then put it back on the shelf. Nevertheless, people trusted their kids, or maybe they just didn't care. I think it's probably partly because parents just didn't care as much. And I remember as a little kid having a lemonade stand. And I suppose we got lemonade powder, because that's how you made lemonade when you were from the suburbs of New Jersey. There was no real effort to make actual lemonade. I mean, you'd get the powder, you'd stick some water in it, you'd stir it around with a big wooden spoon that your parents would then use later to beat you over the head with. But for that time, at least, you had some peace, and the wooden spoon was just used to mix up the lemonade and the powder, the water and the powder. And I remember I lived next door to a golf course. It was like one or two houses away, and we would go to the golf course. I think the golf course is gone now. I'm sure it's condos or something like that. I don't even know. And we would just set up by one of the holes. We'd have a pitcher that we'd walk from my house with some, you know, little paper cups, and I don't know what we would charge, a quarter, 50 cents. And we actually could get a handful of imbeciles that were so desperate for something to drink that they would actually buy our lemonade. So that's just a thought from the past. Is that was a thing back then in the 70s. Now it's inconceivable. Why would kids need to raise money for anything when they can just ask their parents? It's a different world. Now, I'm also thinking back then, and I don't know if I've discussed this before, the cell phone that every kid has, that every human has, really changed the way people not only communicated, but also the way they became socialized. When I was a kid and you wanted to call your friends, you had to call the house phone. A lot of houses only had one telephone, literally, physically one telephone. You'd call and, you know, somebody's parents would pick up and you'd be nervous. And I think I've talked about this before, but what I don't think I mentioned was that the reason why you were nervous calling up your friends' houses, knowing that 95% of the time their parents would answer and you would have to say, "Hi, this is Jeff. Can I speak to John?" I mean, I don't know how many times I did that. The reason is that parents back then in the 70s, I don't know if they just didn't give a shit about their kids the same way, or maybe they cared enough, the right amount. You didn't have the relationship with your friends' parents that my generation has with their kids' friends. So you would call and you talk to these people, and sometimes it was always the mother that answered the phone, by the way, because 95% of the time the mothers were stay at home, didn't work, and the fathers were going to the salt mines or the gravel pit. That's where they were working. When they came home, the last thing they wanted to do was answer the phone and talk to some jerk off friend of their kids. So you'd always have the mother answer, and it was uncomfortable. Because this wasn't somebody that really was in your life in any kind of significant way. She just was kind of hovering a little bit, but not like today where like parents and their kids' friends. I mean, I can't tell you how many times in a row I took my kids' friends to movies, mainly because I just wanted to hang out with them. And then we'd go for pizza after. Of course, I paid for everything every single time, including the tickets. But nevertheless, I went because I wanted to. That was inconceivable when we were kids. Maybe, you know, your parents would take turns in terms of dropping off, driving to the movie theater, and then another parent would pick up and drive everybody home. But no parent actually stayed in the movie theater and watched the movie. It just didn't happen. So nowadays, you know, it's you call up, not that you would ever call a house phone. Most people don't even have house phones. They just have their cell phones. Everybody's got an individual cell phone. Well, back then, there was only the house phone to call. And it's inconceivable I even have friends today that have house phones. You don't even know their number. The phone doesn't even ring. I've got a house line. It doesn't even ring unless it's a wrong number or a robocall or somebody trying to sell me something. If that phone rings, I know that it's not anybody important because anybody important has my cell number. Anyway, so I just wanted to talk about that. And with regard to the music portion of the podcast, this is all music I discovered as a kid. First of all, when music was actually great. Now, I can recognize there was a period before I was born where there was great music. Obviously, the advent of rock and roll in the 50s, and certainly even music before then, 40s, 30s. I've even listened to music from the 20s, and the music was great. So the 60s, the 70s, when I grew up, started listening to music in the 70s, we still listened to the 60s, and then the 80s came, and the 80s was really an underrated decade of music. You had a lot of new wave, you still had some decent rock music, classic rock, not much. Classic rock music really began, I suppose, in the 60s and ended maybe around 1980 or so. But you had other great music. You certainly did into the 80s. The 80s was a great decade, but you didn't have YouTube. You didn't have the internet. You didn't have Spotify. You didn't have Apple Music, iTunes, where you could just look on your phone and pick up a song, or you could go on the internet. That's not how we found music back then. The way we found music was usually word of mouth. I have specific memories of going over to my friend's house, my friend Steve Lapidus. He was very into music, and he loved The Clash as well, Elvis Costello, and we'd sit in his bedroom, and we'd listen to music. People don't do that. Kids don't do that nowadays. You know, he had a band. He had an older brother who was into music, so it would sort of get passed down. That's how you found music back then. You listened to the radio a lot. There were, like, rock stations that were tremendous, and even new wave stations that were just tremendous in the New York area. Also, for me, Rolling Stone magazine is what I got a subscription when I was like 15 years old. Now, that was before it became a leftist shit rag. I never really read the articles. Very rarely did I read the articles. I just wanted to go right to the reviews, the album reviews. And if an album got 4 stars, it was up to 5. If it got 4 stars or more, I would look into it a little bit more and perhaps get that album. That's how I discovered one of my all-time favorites is Graham Parker. And that's how I discovered him, was through Rolling Stone magazine. There was a review of the album Another Gray Area. And that ended up being an album that certainly wasn't one of his classics, but that allowed me to get into his older music. And, you know, I'm a fan 40-something years later. His music is still great. So that was how you discovered music. MTV began, I don't know, maybe I was 15 years old. There was a time that MTV was just music videos. They were VJs instead of DJs. And they'd come on, they'd talk a little bit, and they would just play music. And sometimes you'd get really cutting edge music from MTV. That's how great it was. And then all of a sudden it became the reality shows. And obviously anybody with a brain in their head stopped watching MTV. But there was a period where MTV was a source in which you would find music that you hadn't heard before. I remember I got a lot of music from my father. He was a big fan of 50s music. So that's what got me into the 50s music. I've got a ton of 50s music. When people used to buy CDs, I talked about 8-track tapes and cassettes and vinyl, but CDs I thought was going to be the end. That would be the end. There would never be any need to improve. Well, I haven't bought a CD in a while. I was one of the last people to start downloading music because I felt bad. I felt bad for these great musicians. I felt like I was stealing from them. What are they getting paid a half a penny or 1/10 of a penny for every song that's downloaded? No, I wanted to buy the CD. I've got thousands of them, probably 2,500 or so that I started buying when I was a junior in college or a senior in college. I bought my first CD. The first two that I bought were Steve Winwood, Ark of a Diver, which is a great album, and Elvis Costello, This Year's Model. Those are the first two CDs I bought, I remember. These are things that have a real impact on you. Another thing that was a thing, that's not a thing now, because nobody listens to the radio, really. They listen to satellite radio. I'm talking about terrestrial radio. You'd call radio stations, and they would say, look, the ninth caller, you win tickets to some show, some concert. So you'd call like a maniac. Because you wanted to win those tickets, man. That was a big deal. I remember, I called all the time to the stations I listened to were WNEW, which is 102.7 in New York, and WPLJ, which was 95.5. And there was a time there, I think Kiss FM, it might have been 99.1. It wasn't as good, but there was a period there where they played great music. But you'd call these radio stations. I listened to the radio all the time. I'd be just sitting there listening for hours at night because that's where you got the good music. And calling into the stations, first of all, it rang busy 99% of the time when you'd call in because everybody was calling in trying to get those free tickets. That's just what it was. But every once in a while, the phone would ring, the line would ring, and somebody from the station would pick up. It was like you won the lottery, except you had to be the ninth caller, and then they, it was either a robot voice or it was a human would say number 8, and you were like, "Fuck, man, I got through somehow." You'd depress the receiver, call again. There wasn't like a redial button back then; it was push button. You'd have to redo it 1-2-1-2-9-5, whatever it was. And you'd call over and over and over and over again. Well, guess what? One time I won. I was 17 years old. I was a senior in high school. What was the prize if you got to be the ninth caller, whatever it was? 2 tickets to Lover Boy. All right? Lover Boy. That was the band's name, Lover Boy. And it was at, I think, Forest Hills. I guess the tennis venue had some kind of, it was set up for music. I've never been there for music, so I wouldn't know, but I got through and I won. I won 2 tickets and 2 backstage passes to meet the band Loverboy. Now, Loverboy was not my cup of tea. They were like an early hair band, like a bunch of pretty boys and hair and bandanas and shit like that. So look, I'll be honest with you. I didn't want to go see Loverboy. I don't care that I had backstage passes. I didn't want to meet Loverboy. I had no interest. So I gave the tickets away. They were in my name. And back then you didn't have to show 7 IDs. And I found a friend who was dumb enough clearly to want to see Loverboy. And his name was Andy Tendler. I remember Andy, if you're listening, I'm sorry that I outed you for being a Loverboy fan, but he ended up going with some girl and they went to backstage and met Loverboy. Never. I had scruples when it came to music. I'm not wasting a night on Loverboy and meeting them. Fuck that. There's just no chance that I would go. But the highlight, and the reason I'm telling this story, is not to talk about the Loverboy tickets, but I think it was WNEW that I won them on. They said to me, okay, you know, what's your name? And everything was recorded so that they would then play it a few minutes later and say, here's the lucky guy that won the tickets and the backstage passes for Loverboy. And then the last thing they said to me, and I'm talking to the DJ, this is a big fucking deal. All right, this is like Joe Biden talking to Barack Obama. This is a big fucking deal. I'm famous now, all right? They said, you can play, ask us to play any song you want, and we will play it on the radio. That's what they did. They finished the little kibitzing with the guy that just won the tickets. I was a kid. And then they'd say, okay, what song do you want to hear? And naturally, because I was perverse, and I was into, you know, deep music. I mean, I was a snob. I was a music snob. I'm not going to lie. I wasn't listening to the Archies. I wasn't listening to Sugar Sugar. I was listening to some deep shit at 17. So what was the song that I asked for? It was either N.E.W. or P.L.J. I said, well, Dogs by Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd had a concept album called Animals. It's just incredibly off the charts. Just phenomenal. Very little lyrics. There were some, but it was mainly just incredible guitar and hooks and just a ferocious album. And to me, what was the best song on the album was Dogs. There's only one problem. It was 17 minutes long. And sure as hell, that radio station played Dogs, the entire 17-minute song for me. That was the highlight of my radio career until I started doing radio myself. Now, the downside of radio was that you'd fall in love with these stations and you didn't know about the business of radio. You just listened, you just tuned in and you listened to your music and you listened to it every day. And it was two stations in your car that you listened to. You press a button and it would, the little dial of the radio in your car would kind of zip. It would move over to what the button you pressed. And this was even before they had digital music where you turn a dial and the numbers would just show up like in red. This, sometimes you had a dial. You had like preset buttons. You'd press, depress this plastic button. The radio would move to that station. So you'd be listening like a madman every day. And one day you wake up, you put on your favorite radio station, and God damn it if they're not playing disco. And you're like, whoa, what's going on here? I must have the wrong station. So you'd fiddle around and you'd be like, no. Every time you fiddled, you'd come back to 102.7 or 95. I think it was 95.5 PLJ that changed the formats. And one day, without any warning, they're a disco station. And it's unlistenable. I can't listen to this shit. And they're dead to you. And your heart is broken. I mean, absolutely broken. And you couldn't believe it. It took a while. You listened to a few songs to see if maybe it was a goof. Nope. My hard rock station is now disco. And that was the end of the station. You never listened to them again. And I'm telling you this, the sad resignation that came over you when you realized that your favorite radio station had changed formats was really something. It was a real thing. All right. So again, stream of consciousness. This was a thing in the 70s and 80s. Women nowadays carry mace in their purses. All right. That's what they do if they're, you know, getting raped, I guess. They think they're going to get raped. They take out the mace and they blind their attacker. You know, that's fine. I think that's a good idea. I like the idea of weapons. I think weapons are important, especially to use against bad people. So I'm okay with weapons, with, you know, the mace or the bear spray, or, you know, if you have a knife, whatever girls or women carry in their purses. Back then, that wasn't a thing. What was a thing was a whistle. All right. Women had whistles that were on their keychains, whistles, like, you know, the whistle that your high school gym teacher would have in his mouth. And he's blowing all the time during gym class, whistle. So you're getting attacked, you're getting raped. I mean, I'm not looking to minimize this, but you take out your whistle, you rummage through your bag, you find your keys, takes some time, so whatever. You pull out your keychain, and there's a whistle, and you just blow the shit out of it. And at that point, apparently, I guess all the good guys come and the rape or the attack ends. But that was a thing in the 70s and 80s, the rape whistle. I don't want that lost to posterity, so that's why I had to bring that up. I don't know that it necessarily fits in this podcast, but I don't want anybody to forget the rape whistle. Now all you kind people that are listening, you won't forget. Take out that keychain, and there's that rape whistle. So that was a thing. Now, other things I want to talk about today. I was hired this past week to represent Puff Daddy's son, Justin Combs, in connection with this raid. There were raids on two of Puff Daddy's homes, one in California and one in Miami. And they were really bonkers raids. I mean, they had like small armies with armored vehicles and like helicopters and people with armor on, and it was crazy. It was literally an invasion of two of his homes, a military invasion. And it was kind of shocking to me. Now, I know, look, I try to talk about this stuff objectively, even though I'm involved in the case. I don't know Puff Daddy, just so you know. I've represented tons of people in the rap industry, but my paths have never crossed with him. So I don't know what the government thinks he is or what they think that he's not. They could feel that he's violent. I try to be objective. FBI agents that are listening or former FBI agents are saying, hey, Jeff, you know, it's known that the guy has guns, or there could be people on the premises with guns. You can't just go there and knock on the door. You've got to have a show of force so that the agents are protected. I know that's what many people are thinking, and I can't disagree with that. I get it. The agents need to be kept safe. But the idea that the FBI or whoever is doing the search in a situation, not necessarily this case, the DEA, it's usually overboard. And it usually freaks people out that shouldn't be getting freaked out, that are innocent in all this. And what bothers me the most about it is not so much the search, the overboard search that occurred in Puff Daddy's two homes, but the fact that the press was certainly told about it either immediately or right before. They were all there ready to record it. They were all there told about it and breathlessly reporting what anonymous agents, law enforcement, are telling them about what they're looking for, evidence of sex trafficking. That's bad, because that's just an evil thing for our government or law enforcement to do. It's one thing to be heavy-handed, and I think I talked about it in a prior podcast. I had an 18-year-old client who the federal government was investigating, and we received subpoenas. We responded. I spoke to the prosecutors many times and said, look, the kid's going back to school in the fall. If you need him to come in to surrender, if you're going to charge him, just tell me and we'll bring him in. We've obviously, every time he's left the state, we've told you where he's been. We're going to cooperate with you. He's living with a bunch of kids in college. We don't want to scare them. Just let us know and I'll bring the kid in that day. And they understood. They said, we get it. And sure enough, when they wanted to arrest the kid, they stormed his dorm room in college and scared the living bejesus out of everybody. And it was completely unnecessary, because as I said, we were going to surrender. They then consented to bail without posting any property, which means they obviously didn't feel that he was a flight risk. If they wanted to search his room, it could have been two agents knocking on the door. They could have told me as soon as they removed the people from the room, saying, look, we're going to search. Is this okay? We don't want to have any problems. We don't want to make this uglier. I obviously would have agreed to. This is what the feds do. The idea that they're completely clean and innocent on what they did with Puff Daddy is ludicrous. It's just not true. By using the press to leak what they're looking for, they're just dirtying a potentially future jury pool. I mean, they use the press to smear Puff Daddy, Sean Combs, for one reason: to deny him a fair trial, to turn public opinion against him. That's un-American, all right? You have a right to a fair trial, one that's not going to be dirtied by the government because they want to win a case. As Barack Obama would say, that's not who we are, all right? So it's not right when they do such a thing like they did to Puff Daddy. The heavy-handedness is one thing, but to alert the press, to talk anonymously to the press. And in this case, it seems like their investigation, the blueprint for it is this insane civil suit that was filed a couple of months ago by a disgruntled former associate of Puff Daddy. And if you actually make an effort, go on the internet, it's available. And you can read this complaint, and it's just utterly bonkers. There's photos on every page. It's written in slang. It's clearly written in an effort to get as much publicity as possible, not only for the case, but for the lawyer whose name I don't even remember, some maniac. And the feds, the idea that they're taking that stuff as gospel, which it very well may be they are, is almost hard to believe. And I've checked it out, and some of the stuff is patently obviously false. But, you know, when the government wants you, they're going to do everything they can to get you, just like they did it with El Chapo's wife when I represented her, Emma Coronel. They were leaking like crazy, doing anything they could to hurt her chances for a fair trial. They did the same thing when El Chapo's son Ovidio was being extradited from Mexico. They were leaking pictures of him in the plane. You know, the government is not always good. And not always honest and doesn't always play by the rules. In fact, oftentimes does not play by the rules. So that's upsetting. I'll give you more information as it comes about if I can with regard to my involvement in that case. But I'm proud to represent Puff Daddy's son, Justin. He's a good kid. He's polite. Again, I don't know enough about the case to make any real value judgments. I'm not going to sit here and advocate because that's not what this is about. I'm just here to talk about the raid, which I thought was ridiculous. Now, other things that are going on in the news, of course, it's my pet cause. We've got to talk about the war in the Middle East. We're going to talk about this very briefly in Gaza. You know, aid is being dropped at such unprecedented levels. They're dropping it on all the terrorists in Gaza. Many countries are doing it. There are so many places in the world that are where people are starving, where people are being massacred by Muslim terrorists. No aid is being dropped. Nobody gives a shit. So why is Gaza, why is this place, this terror enclave, this disease terror enclave, why are they so beloved? Because their supporters are the loudest. Because they're threatening to affect the American election coming up. And that's why all of this is happening. And it's really pathetic. All it's doing is giving terrorists a blueprint on how to achieve their aim by just complaining loudly. And their complaints are 99% are utter propaganda lies. But this is what we're dealing with. I mean, there is no place on earth with terrorists as bad as the ones in Gaza. The Israel Defense Forces found weapons hidden inside pillows inside a hospital the other day. Weapons in hospital beds and ceilings of patient rooms inside the walls of the maternity ward, including dozens of mortar shells. There's rifles, explosive devices, sniper rifles and pistols, ammunition. I mean, this is what Palestinians use hospitals for. This is what they use mosques for. If there is a mosque in Gaza, if there is a hospital in Gaza, if there is a school in Gaza, it is being used to hide terrorists and weapons because they know that Israel will be less likely to attack it because they don't want the bad publicity. Of course, Israel has shown that they're not going to be deterred, which is why you're getting all these cries about fake genocide and fake massacres. What's incredible to me is that the world is loudly turning on Israel. Even in Kamala Harris threatened Israel with repercussions if they dare to try to root out the terrorists in Rafah, which is a border area between Gaza and Egypt. I mean, they're openly rooting for Hamas. This is where we are. But in all the screaming from the world against Israel, there's never a peep about Iran, which is the terror regime, which started the war and which also armed Hezbollah in Lebanon. I mean, there's no talk about that war that started unprovoked on October 7th, in which hundreds or thousands of rockets have been launched against Israeli civilians from Lebanon. There's not even any talk about it. Nobody's asking for a ceasefire there. Why? You know, because, you know, it's not Palestinians. And Israel isn't really killing anybody. So they feel like it's okay if Israel takes rockets. Who cares about them? They're just Israelis. 80,000 people, and I've talked about this, have been driven from their homes since October, and there's not a peep from Joe Biden demanding that it stop. Not a peep from the presidents and prime ministers of all the European countries against Hezbollah, against Iran. It's just astonishing how this has become. And an example of the loud propaganda against Israel, which is designed to simply change foreign policy, can be found on college campuses. But one school finally had enough, and this is no joke. This is a big deal, and this is what why I'm bringing it up. Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee, they're showing you how you handle Hamas students, pro-Hamas students. A Muslim terror group, Students for Justice in Palestine, and they are a Muslim terror group. They've said they're fully aligned with Hamas. They decided to push their way into an administration building on Vanderbilt's campus. They were told not to. They were told that if they came in and demonstrated there, protested there, they'd be suspended. But these terrorist students have seen that they've been able to do this all across the country, so they figured they'd do it at Vanderbilt as well. And they'd bully people into supporting a ceasefire, which is really designed just to keep Hamas alive. As they forced their way into a building, they assaulted a security guard to get in, and they refused to leave for 22 hours. Vanderbilt handled their Muslim terror business the right way. They had 4 of the terrorist students arrested, and they suspended 16 in total, kicking them off campus. That's it. You're gone. You're suspended. Try again in the fall to come back. That's how you handle your Muslim terror business if you're an American university, because now a lot of these kids are, you know, these do-gooder, virtue-signaling white students that need to show the world that they're not racist by standing up for Muslim terror. They got to tell their parents that, you know, $37,500 that they spent for that semester has now been flushed down the toilet. And that will deter more Muslim terror violence on Vanderbilt's campus. You don't allow them to assault students and staff the way they're allowed to at Columbia, Harvard, Cornell, Rutgers, MIT. You don't allow them to threaten students with no repercussions the way they're allowed to at Emory, at Northwestern, and dozens of other schools. At MIT, Muslim terror students were told if you enter administration buildings, you're getting suspended. They don't care because they have no respect for the law. These are you're fucking savages. They did it. And instead of suspending them, the school realized, well, if we suspend them, a lot of these kids are not citizens. They're here on student visas. If they're suspended, then they'll have to go back to the terrorist shithole that they came from. So naturally, MIT backed down because MIT is pro-Hamas terror, and they didn't suspend the students that they said that they would. At Columbia, Muslim terror students were told that they weren't allowed on campus to protest after their Muslim terror organizations were suspended. They don't care. They did so anyway. They're screaming for genocide, death of Jews, destruction of Israel. None of them got suspended. Maybe one because he attacked somebody. My client, who sprayed a fart spray, a novelty non-toxic fart spray, sprayed it during the protest, the violent protest, as the Muslim terror students were screaming for his death. He was suspended by Columbia for 2 years. Okay, the Muslim terror students calling for the death and destruction of Jews worldwide weren't suspended for an hour. A kid who sprayed a fart spray, a non-toxic fart spray that he got off of Amazon with a cartoon ass on the front of the bottle, was suspended for 2 years. At Northwestern, the Jew hate is so bad on campus that Congress is now investigating the university for their anti-Semitism and their failure to respond to it. So what did the university do to show that they're combating anti-Semitism? Well, they created the President's Advisory Committee on Preventing Anti-Semitism and Hate at Northwestern. They're going to show Congress how serious they are about fighting Jew hate. So, of course, the first thing the committee did, was invite a well-known Jew-hating professor, a crazed Muslim terror supporter, to lecture the committee on Islamophobia, of course. Members of the anti-Semitism committee, they include people who worked in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel, targeting Israel, and as well another member pushed to boycott Israeli academic institutions, I read. I mean, this is what passes for an anti-Semitism committee, a committee that's filled with Jew haters. The moral to the story, send your kids to Vanderbilt or Pepperdine in Malibu, not to a school like Northwestern, which openly allows Muslim terror on campus. And I have to tell you, as an employer, when I see that a student graduates from Harvard or Columbia or Cornell or Northwestern, I don't recognize their traditional academic excellence, these universities. I presume they got into these schools due to either affirmative action, because that's what these schools want, is to level the playing field by bringing in people that don't belong there, or that the students are just openly anti-Israel. And that's how they got into the school, by talking about their leftist, Jew-hating bona fides. I assume that students from Harvard, Columbia, Cornell, or Northwestern may be inferior intellectually, and that the school let them in for reasons having nothing to do with their brain power. That's what Jew hate has done to American college campuses. And I've noticed also online on Twitter that there's so many white supremacists that are openly aligned with Muslim terrorists against Israel. And it doesn't really make any sense, because you're a white supremacist. That means you hate brown people. You hate anybody but white people. You're Aryan. You're for Hitler. That's what you want. But remember, Hitler aligned with Palestinians as well back then. He aligned with those brown people because the one thing they had in common, just as they do today, the white supremacists and the Muslim terrorists, is they both hate Jews. So I thought about it. What makes a white supremacist hate Jews so much, more than their traditional foe, the brown person? Well, they're usually uneducated morons from lower socioeconomic classes of society, and they're frustrated at their lots in life. They feel they have no power, they've got no money, and they see Jews as a group that are successful monetarily in terms of positions of power. So their jealousy drives them to want to destroy the very group that has everything that they want and they can't get. And it's mainly because they're lazy fucking idiots. And that's why they can't get what they want. But they'll never, you know, take a look in the mirror and say, of course, this is my fault. They got to blame the Jews. They don't see that Jews came to America with nothing. And they just work their asses off for their success. The white supremacists who openly hate anything that's not white, they hate Jews so much that they've aligned themselves with Muslim terrorists, brown people, again, who are their natural enemies. And white supremacists claim to love America, but they align with the very people that did 9/11, who openly hate America, all because they hate Jews more. Okay, I'm done with the heavy stuff, although not all of this was heavy. I want to talk about the music. I want to talk about the music. I want to talk about the greatest album ever. I know you've been waiting for this the entire podcast. I'm going to deliver now. The greatest album ever. I'm going to play a few tunes, parts of a few tunes off of it. And I'll tell you this. There has never been an album that had more catchy songs than this album. There has never been an album that you loved this much the first time. Sometimes you listen to music, it takes a few times before it sort of seeps into your brain, before that worm can get into your brain and you can't stop listening to the melodies, the hooks. This is an album that was ready made. The first time you listened to it, you couldn't get enough of it. And I first listened to it when I was a senior in high school. This is 1983. It is now 41 years later. And I love this band and I love this album as much as I did from when I first listened to it. Now, I'm not going to say the name of the band yet, but I'm going to play the first minute off the first song of their first album. Mr. Producer, hit it.
Check you out. Let me go wild.
Jesus, that was good. Am I right? I mean, it's a song about masturbation if you listen to the lyrics, but it was the album, the band, the Violent Femmes, they were kids. Two of them were teenagers at the time they formed, and they talked about teenage angst. I don't even know what the music can be categorized as. Is it garage rock? Is it punk rock? Is it new wave? To me, it's just a bunch of nervous energy with hooks. I just find the album to be incredible. Now, I need you to listen to this full album. The album is simply called Violent Femmes. That's it. You have to listen to a little bit more of this. I'm sorry you have to, but it's that good. I'm giving you gold. Okay, I'm giving you gold. The first 54 seconds off of Kiss Off. All right, listen to the first 54 seconds. Mr. Producer, go.
Someone, a person to talk to, someone who cared to love. Could it be you? Could it be you? Situation gets rough and I start to panic. It's not enough. It's just a habit, a kid, you're sick. Well, darling, this is it. You can all just kiss off into the air. Behind my back, I can see them stare. They'll hurt me bad, but I won't mind. They'll hurt me bad, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
They do it all the time.
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 How good is that? But then later in the song, I'm going to give you from a minute 37 to 2:43 of the song. Listen to this section. This is iconic music. I don't know what kind of music it is, but it's iconic. Listen, go ahead.
I take one, cause you left me, and two for my family, and three for my heartache, and four for my headaches, and five for my lonely, and six for my sorrow, and seven no tomorrow, and eight, I forget what eight was for, but nine for lost God, ten for everything. Oh, you can all just kiss off into the air. Behind my back, I can see them stare. They'll hurt me bad, but I won't mind. They'll hurt me bad, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they do it all the time.
The next song, Add It Up. Listen to this. Listen to this madness that was in a song that I listened to when I was 18 years old. The song is Add It Up, from the 38-second mark to a minute 32. Mr. Producer, go.
Things I wouldn't miss. If I look at your pants and I need a kiss. Why can't I get just one screw? Why can't I get just one screw? Believe me, I know what to do, but something won't let me make love to you. Just one day.
That's just pure gold. It's gold, Jerry. It's gold. First 45 seconds of the song The Promise. Hit it, Mr. Producer.
Well, you know that I want your loving, but my logic tells me never gonna happen. And then my defenses say I didn't want it anyway. But you know, sometimes I'm a liar. Could you ever want me to love you? Could you ever want me to care? disregard my nervousness. Please ignore my vacant stares. Just what I've been through, it's nothing like where I'm going to. Give me some sign to pursue a promise.
Amazing. Amazing stuff. The first 50 seconds of Prove My Love. You can't get better music in one place. This one album has it all. The first 50 seconds of Prove My Love. Go ahead, hit it, Mr. Producer.
Just last night, I was reminded of just how bad it had gotten and just how sick I had become. But it could change with this relationship deranged. We've all been through some shit. If what thing, I think this thing's begun. Oh, tell me now.
What do I have to do?
Oh, tell me now.
What do I have to do?
And now I suppose I can play, if you want to call it the single from the album, the hit of the album. It wasn't, but it was probably their most polished song, and it was their first hit, if I can call it that. Gone Daddy Gone, the first 40 seconds. Mr. Producer, go ahead. And finally, to show that they can do a slow song instead of that insane cacophony of sound that somehow makes sense. It somehow makes sense. It's a guitarist. It's a bassist. It's a drummer. There are three guys from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Here is a slow song, the last song on the album, the first minute, 1 minute of Good Feeling. This song is just, it's the balls. Listen to it. Now, that song was great. Now, you got to listen to the album. I beg of you. I beg of you. I beg of you. Especially if you're in college, you need to listen to this entire album. Not once, not twice, 100 times. It's that good from beginning to end. The Violent Femmes, the name of the album is Violent Femmes. They had a handful of other albums after. Their second one, these were songs that they had done at the same time they wrote the first album. They just saved it for the second album. And it's got some Christian stuff in it. Jesus walking on the water. There's some Christian stuff in there. It starts getting a little weird, but there is a great song on that second album, the song Never Tell. I'm not going to play any of it. You've heard enough, but the song Never Tell is just off the charts. The third album, they became popular now, if you can call it that. The third album, Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads produced it, and it was much more slick and much more polished, and they had a great song, No Killing on it is the name of the song. They covered a T-Rex song, and it was sort of a minor hit. What I remember, and then they had a few albums after they broke up, and they came back, and they were obviously never the same. They had some good songs after that third album, American Music is one of them, which was actually a hit. I think hit number two in the charts. But what I remember, my last gasp with the Violent Femmes, I was at Duke in law school, so this has to be 1989, I suppose, and I went to go see them in concert, I think in Raleigh, and I forgot to bring earplugs. Now, when I was a kid going to concerts, when I was 13, 14, 15, 16, nobody cared about, you know, their ear health. They just went and your ears would ring for a day. And then the next time you'd go to a concert, your ears would ring after for 2 days and you'd steadily be damaging your ears and you were too stupid to know what you were doing. When I was 20 years old, I woke up from a very bad cold one morning. I had a bad cold and the cold was clearing up. And when I woke up, the cold was gone, but I had ringing in my ears and it didn't go away. It was 24/7. It wasn't really loud, but it was loud enough that when I would go to sleep at night, when it was quiet, I could hear it very loud. It's called tinnitus, spelled like tinnitus. It's a ringing in the ears that is incurable and has been, I guess, since forever, since it first became a thing. And any musician that's listening to the show, I suspect, knows what I'm talking about. The ringing in the ears that does not go away. It can't really be masked. It's just there, and it just drives you nuts. And more importantly, it slowly robs your hearing because the ringing gets louder over time, over decades, and you can hear less and less. So, and I still have it now. I'm doing this this podcast, and I've got headphones on, and what I hear is not just my voice, but I hear ringing, and then it gets steadily louder as, you know, as the years go on. But I remember going to see the Violent Femmes in Raleigh, and God damn it, if I didn't forget earplugs. At that point, I was concerned. I was 24 years old, and I knew that I had the ring in my ears, and I knew that I needed to be away from loud sounds because it would just make things worse. So I would, if I ever went to a concert, and I went to less and less at that point because of the danger to my ears, the damage to my ears, is I would go to the drugstore and buy these like waxy balls, things that you'd stick in your ears to sort of get rid of the really loud sounds from hitting your ear canal. And I forgot them that night. And I remember thinking, do I just leave? If I stay, they're very loud. I'm going to, you know, damage my hearing. And I just couldn't leave. I mean, I love the Violent Femmes that much, and I suffered through it. And I remember there being physical pain in my ears as the music was so loud, and just thinking, why does it have to be so loud? Why can't it be soft? But it was loud, and my ears rang even louder for days and days after that. But I wish I could say that it was worth it to see the Violent Femmes and lose another 5% of my hearing. Probably wasn't worth it, but at that time, I thought it was. Jeffrey Lichtman for Beyond the Legal Limit. Thanks for tuning in. You can find me on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Thanks again. I know this was a different type of podcast. See you next week.